Very sad loss, Diana Rigg. We lost Diana Rigg this week.
I thought about you because I think you're obviously a big Avengers fan.
I'm a big
fan
of the British Avengers fan. I mean, she was one of my earliest heartthrobs. In fact, I even have a postcard picture of her just up by my desk. It's been there since I was like, I mean, I've had this since I was a postgrad. And it always just like ended up whenever I like relocated desks or offices or whatever. It just as part of the paraphernalia, you pack all your desk stuff away and you unpack it wherever you end up. And it's always ended up. And I mean, I don't know if we're going to record this, but I mean, I might as well show it to you. But it's a part of my. It's the point where I realise, you know, I've lost. No, it's right here. Yeah, just pinned up right here. There you go. So that's my. Diana Rigg picture.
Gorgeous.
Classic picture. Yeah, she was gorgeous. Bless her. So I'll miss her. And you know, seems like a really decent sort and a very interesting character. So.
Yeah, well, it's good finding out today that article with.
That was amazing, wasn't it? That article.
Name? Edgar Wright. Yeah.
Edgar Wright. Yeah.
And she's going to be. Yeah, her last film was his kind of horror. He's making a horror horror film.
And literally recording some of the last bits of dialogue from her bedside.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, I mean, I'm not going to watch that with that tear in my eyes now.
Yeah, yeah.
So a little show and tell. So this, again, got towards the end of a month. I'm just thinking, I just need a little pick me up. So in previous months, got myself like a beer machine. Beer machine's going really well. Very pleased with it. This will appeal to you. Okay, 3D printed.
Oh.
Deckard's Blade Runner blaster.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
I know. I mean, it's got a bit of heft to it, but it is resin based. So what I'm going to be doing over the next couple of weeks is like filing down the rough bits. And painting it. And
so at the moment it's just for the benefit of the listeners, it's just white.
It's just white, yeah.
But it looks cool.
But the same dude who did this, I don't know what the copyright situation is here, and I'm not going to explore, but the same guy who did this also does an Aliens pulse rifle.
Wow.
You know, the pulse rifle. So that, if anybody's listening who cares deeply about me, Christmas is on its way. If I found an alien's pulse rifle, you know, space marine, a marine's pulse rifle in my Christmas stocking this year, I would not be unappreciative.
Yeah, they've got at the bottom of it is the grenade launcher.
That's the grenade launcher. I'm guessing it'll. I mean, like this is all just solid. It's all, you know, it's all just for show. A fully operational one would be something else. But you know, even I can't stretch to these kinds of prices, Danny. So how you been doing? How you got a nice like GI haircut going on there?
Those of us this is typical. It's just this is the missus does this. I get the crew cut.
Yeah,
it's easy.
You not try doing it for yourself? Because I mean, I you know, as our listeners may or may not know, I mean, I and you are follically challenged. I'm further along the line, obviously, but it gets to that point where I can just do my own. You just run the mower over your hair, just everywhere, and then job done. But you still feel you need somebody to come and
it's just get it done more completely.
Yeah, and the beard's looking quite nicely groomed as well.
Yeah, well, it's completely nearly all grey now.
Yeah, well, you and me both, buddy. You ever thought of growing like a whole full-on ZZ Top beard?
I did.
During lockdown, I didn't think about it. I thought, we're in lockdown now. Who's going to care? I might as well just give it a go.
Well, and I spent some time in Saudi Arabia, and I did grow a big old beard then because it's like when in Rome.
Yeah. Did you like the look?
Yeah, I did actually. Quite liked it. Yeah. But I couldn't stop playing about with it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Your beard.
Did you plait it at all?
I think it nearly got to that stage, but no, it's a bit different type of hair, isn't it? It's difficult to.
Yeah, it is. Vikings used to do it. There was. I know you've not been on the Facebook site for a while for various reasons, but there was a conversation about kind of the philosophers and their hair that cropped up. I can't remember the point of it all, but I'm sure there was a very important philosophical point to be made.
Wasn't it that your beardy kind of hairier, kind of more left wing or more kind of
anti-establishment? But yeah, I mean, you do tend to go with Nietzsche with the big old handlebar moustache there going on and so on. Yeah, maybe the hairier you are, maybe the more radical you are. I don't know. I don't think we need to get into that one particularly. So So we did a whole raft of sessions when we were talking about ethics, and we were talking broadly about kind of, you know, deontological versus teleological consequential ethics, and I think it did our heads in, didn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean,
we ended up with kind of, you know, we really want to be nice to people. We're not entirely sure why.
Going through so much philosophy in one go, it's quite difficult. Yes. Focus is a, you know, important thing, isn't it?
Because I don't think, because, you know, any of people who've joined us late in the day here may not appreciate that we record a whole bunch of casts over kind of a period of at least 2 hours. So we just chat for 2 hours on a given topic, and then Danny waves his magic editing wand over that 2 hours, cuts out all the swearing and the crying, and the recriminations, and then just, you know, hones it down to usually kind of four chunks of half hour, or, you know, maybe five chunks of 20 minutes, to feed to the masses. So that's how we roll. So yeah, 2 hours worth of that. By the last podcast, I think we would get, you know, our heads were really starting to overheat a bit.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we're starting a new theme here on that kind of issue of the kind of head to head philosopher versus philosopher, ideology versus ideology sort of cage fight. And we thought we might chat a little bit about knowledge, didn't we? And associated issues, kind of. And it's a biggie. I mean, that's the one that a lot of philosophers really kind of key into from the start. That's the kind of almost the breeding ground of philosophy. You know, what do you know? What do you know? Mm. How do you know?
Well, is it possible to know?
Is it possible? Yeah. What is it? What is it possible? I mean, do you feel? I mean, we've had this conversation. Do you feel you know enough?
You mean of my reality, or, you know, or the, you know, things around me, or objects or ideas?
Well, I mean, you know, it's like a Heideggerian sort of thing. It's like, you know, we've talked about Heidegger and the idea that we are thrown in an unnegotiated way into the world. So it's almost, without being too tacky about this, it's like, you know, yeah, the gates are opened, you're chucked into the world without so much to buy your leave. Nobody says to you, oh, you know, do you fancy operating in this reality? If so, we've got a biological process which will eject your consciousness into the world. You up for that? And I'm thinking, well, I don't know. Let me think about it. You know, it's not that kind of decision making process. It's just, you're suddenly there, and slowly but surely, you come to consciousness again, as Hegel says. And this is I think Hegel's really kind of down with the whole idea of the kind of the newborn, because he sees the universe in a sense as a kind of a newborn. Coming to an awareness, slowly but surely, your consciousness starts to kind of kick in. You start to kind of recognize who you are, in contradistinction to the rest of the world. So you can look at the rest of the world and you start to identify it as particular aspects of other things, rather than it being necessarily part of you. And then you start to realize we're actually all part of the same universe. And you start to kind of... So your consciousness becomes much more focused, much more aware, much sharper. So the question there is, okay, you know, once you start to realize, kind of, you know, get a sense of who and what you are, then the way you operate in the world is very much down to kind of, do you feel you have enough operational information? Is there enough in the handbook to help you to set your life up and to keep it running properly? Or do you feel that your life was given to you with instructions in another language, or one of these things that only gives you like one pamphlet of instructions just with pictures and no actual description of what you're supposed to do? You think, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. You know, am I supposed to put that there or here, or you know, am I supposed to kind of think this or that, or what am I supposed to trust? It's that kind of question. It's like, you know, it's that thrownness of being. You're here in the world. Do you know enough to make it work for you, do you think? Well, thank you, folks. Great for you to chime in here today. Danny's just gone. I think he's gone and lie down here.
I had a train of thought, but it left the station without me.
As long as it was wearing a mask, it's fine.
I think I'm trying to, in my mind, make a distinction between like knowledge of everyday objects.
Mm.
Like how do, like what is it important to know in the world? Knowledge of everyday objects. Like, do we really need to know how we know those things?
Mm.
Why is it important that we need to know those? How we know those things?
Yes. Basic operational knowledge seems to come to us, for the most part, relatively easily. So, you know, we learn how to stand up and walk around. And experientially, we learn how to kind of avoid bumping into things. And you know, we learn not to kind of hurt ourselves by putting ourselves in particular dangerous situations, for the most part. And we recognise, I mean, it's kind of Platonic. I mean, Plato was quite, you know, famously liked to try and prove a point. He had this idea that all knowledge was present in the human mind, that we were born with all knowledge. We'd just forgotten it. So it was present when we were part of the great kind of universal consciousness, the great universal spirit, whatever, before we became physically incarnate. We had all knowledge, but we kind of forgot it. And education is for the most part, remembrance. It's just trying to remember the stuff we'd forgotten, perhaps from a previous life or in a previous existence. And he used to grab like an urchin off the street and used to say to this urchin, "Okay, well, you know, if I wanted to get you to go to the market for me to buy me a banana or something, I don't know. Do you get bananas in Greece?" I don't know whether you grow them or not. So, you know, it's a place. If I wanted you to get me a banana from the market over
some
there,
olives.
Or some olives. Olives would be better. Olives is getting behind the Greek economy. So how would you get there? Would you walk from where we're standing now in a straight line to the market? Or would you go all the way around the temple over there, and then round the back of those kind of dwellings, and then past the kind of the official building, and round to the other side to get there? And the urchin would say, "Well, no, that would be a long way around. It's obvious that the easiest way for me to get to the market is to go from where I am now, in a straight line, to the market." And Plato would turn round to the crowd and say, "Well, there you are, this urchin, without any training, knows that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line."
Mm-hmm.
And this is a mathematical, so this is a geometrical. Truism, that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. We didn't need to teach him that. We didn't have to show him the equations. He just knew it through, you know, we just brought it out of his mind.
Innate knowledge.
Yeah, so, I mean, so to some extent, we could say, well, that sort of thing we do know. We, you know, if I see you kind of standing across the road, then I know that the best way to get to you is across the road in a straight line, looking left and right to make sure I don't get knocked over. Mm. There's all kinds of stuff like that. We know when we're hungry and thirsty, what we need to do to solve it out. So those kinds of functional knowledges, fairly down with. But I'm guessing you're making a distinction between that and some of the more higher level decision making processes, like as we were saying in the previous part, should I steal this thing if I'm hungry and my family are hungry? Do I have the right to steal from this shop to feed my family, or is this still morally reprehensible? Should I vote for this particular party or that particular party? Should I go to war or should I not go to war? So you say there might be a difference between those two?
I think that is part of it, but I think that what I think has kind of knocked me off my course of thinking in preparation for this is I tend to come at this from the kind of 20th century thinking to do with, you know, language. I have to mention Wittgenstein's name.
You have to, don't you? Really?
That it is strangely, it kind of, the way I see about, the way I look at the history of knowledge is, in philosophy, is that philosophy kind of gives up at one point. we can't know anything anyway. Okay, let's talk about something else. And talk about language. And what I'm trying to get to with knowledge, is knowledge itself, does that mean we have a word for something? Because the reason I say that is, I believe we have lots of kind of feelings about the world, looking at the outside world. We had feelings about it, intuitions about it. But it can't be stabbed down unless it has... unless it has a word, unless it has a kind of a language. So I'm thinking that I'm kind of making a distinction between that kind of idea and the kind of everyday, you know, how, like Plato says, how do we know, you know, a circle's a circle? This kind of, how do we get to the point of knowledge that way? Can we kind of link that two together in some way?
I've
totally thrown you.
I see what you're getting at. I can see what you're getting at there, and I think that's how we codify our knowledge, don't we? We kind of experience a range of things, or experience physical phenomena in the world, and in order to link that, I mean, I don't know if any people have read any Jonathan Swift. Gulliver's Travels. It's been a long, long time since I read this, and some of our listeners may well be able to fill in the details for me. But people always think, oh, well, Gulliver's Travels, it's just about him meeting the, you know, going to an island full of little people and having adventures as a giant with all these little people. But the story actually has him visiting a number of different islands, and each island has a different kind of message, because each island is occupied by different kinds of people, and he goes to an island which is essentially populated by philosophers, and these philosophers have got to the point where they think, well, we can't know, we haven't got the ability to kind of codify in absolute detail all the objects and experiences that we come across, so the only way we can communicate accurately, because we are philosophers, the only way we can communicate accurately with people is to actually show them the object that we are referring to. So you could tell that the philosophers were around because they just had these huge kind of like backpacks and stuff, and they were festooned with objects and things, because if they wanted to communicate with you, they would have to show you the objects. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to communicate.
They can't be sure that you're understanding the same thing they are.
Yes, yes.
So in Wittgenstein, in the Philosophical Investigations, He disproves the idea of a private language. He does this by talking about, okay, well, a private language must mean no one else can know what we're talking about at all. Only I can know what we're talking about.
Mm.
And he comes up with this idea of a sensation. Whenever I have this sensation, I'm going to write S in my diary.
Yes. Yes.
And then, the upshot of that is that as soon as you try to add any kind of qualification for this sensation, like, oh, the sensation is I get an itch in my armpit, then you've entered the normal language. So you can't make reference to that private language. So therefore, yeah, that private language can't exist. So I'm thinking, like, when you're looking out at the world, in a kind of like a Kantian way, all the information's coming in, all the sense data's coming in, but it's not knowledge until we have a word for it.
Okay, I can see where you're going with this. It reminds me a tad. I'm not sure. I have to say, I'm not sure. I'm 100% behind the Wittgensteinian spin you're putting on this, but I'm prepared to pursue it. The inevitable Star Trek reference here. The episode, I think it was called Darmok. It was where they meet. It's shot full of logical holes, and it doesn't take much to realise that, you know, there are some serious gaps in the narrative. But nevertheless, they're trying to make a particular point about communication, and they meet this. You know, the Enterprise meets this group of aliens in another ship, and they're trying to communicate with each other. And they say, "Well, we can't, because the people on this other ship just seem to be talking gibberish." As it happens, they're not talking gibberish. The words are recognisable, but they're saying things like, you know, Mirab, his sails unfurled, and the river in winter. I said, what do they mean by this? And it tops up that this species communicates by metaphor and analogy, and they're drawing on their own history. So if somebody says the river in winter, what they mean is we need to stop, because the river freezes, such and such a river freezes in winter. And so that means stop what we're doing. You know, if you say Mirab, his sails unfurled. There was a mythological figure called Mirab who was a sailor, and when his sails are unfurled, it means that his boat is moving. So, you know, if he says Mirab, his sails unfurled, it means let's go, let's leave. Mm. And the famous kind of line that crops up in the episode where he's trying to kind of build a communication bridge with Picard. Mm. And trying to kind of make them realise that, you know, they should kind of have some sort of, you know, meaningful relationship. He says, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. Mm. And it's like, and he's trying to figure out, what does that mean? Who is Darmok and Jalad? And it works out that these are two mythical characters who, in their mythology, met as enemies and then left as friends together.
Yeah.
Having... overcome some adversity. So it's kind of Darmok on the ocean. So somebody's on the ocean, so they're kind of alone and isolated. So yeah, Jalad is on the ocean. Oh, so he was alone and isolated. Mm. And then it's like, you know, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. Okay, they meet at an island, and then Darmok and Jalad on the ocean. Oh, right, so they both leave together. Mm. And you know, so that idea of having an experience and then trying to symbolise that experience.
Yeah.
The semiology of that makes some kind of, it does make some kind of sense. It's how we pack the symbols.
Yes.
Somebody and whether or not we recognise the same symbols. I mean, one of the characters in the Star Trek show was saying, we know how they're communicating now, so we should be able to understand him. So, well, no, we don't, because it'd be like us saying to them, Juliet on her balcony.
Mm.
Now, we know that Juliet on her balcony would refer to romance, perhaps, or love. Mm. And that would be an image we would probably get. But another culture who was not familiar with the works of Shakespeare, or certainly not familiar with Romeo and Juliet, that would not make any sense. That would just be words, meaningless words, referring to an event or to some kind of experience that they were not familiar with.
Yeah.
And so the idea of symbols capturing our experiences and reflecting objects in the world, that kind of that semiology makes sense. But then, are we using the same reference?
Yeah, there's a modern film, isn't there? I think it's called Arrival.
Mm.
It's about humans trying to communicate with aliens.
Mm-hmm.
But then, have you seen that one?
I haven't. No.
Yes. So yeah, it's a similar thing. They have to, I think it's, you know, similar to another, yeah, Star Trek reference. I think you mentioned before. I think in your book, one of your books of
free plugs there, guys.
In Deep Space Nine, so they see time as like continuous, like a loop,
non-linear time. Yeah, yeah. Yes. First episode. Yeah.
Yeah. So trying to go back to my point, which I think I started very badly, but I think I meant well.
Yeah, you always do, though, Dan.
So yeah, going back to Plato and what I'm talking about. So Plato talks about forms. So we understand what a circle is because it's an act of recollection.
Mm.
There's an ultimate, there's an ultimate circle out there.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is, we recognize a circle as a circle because we're entering in language. We both, as children will stumble across the word circle and there's recognition,
mm-hmm.
Therefore, that becomes knowledge.
Yes.
So I'm kind of stuck in that kind of 20th century version of trying to understand the theory of knowledge. But there's so much, obviously, before we get there.
I think that makes sense because the semiology of kind of language and of numbers and so on, they're ways of capturing kind of almost like atoms of data.
Mm.
So a word might capture a particular experience or a particular object. A number may contain some kind of reference to quantity or whatever. And maybe we have to do that. Maybe we have to convert all of this kind of manifold. Kant kind of says this in a way that, we have to kind of, all these kind of manifolds of experience have to be ordered. Otherwise, you can't create a sentence out of it, in a sense. You can't create knowledge unless you've got a protocol for connecting these things together. And one of the protocols we use for connecting these data packages together is language. So it's like having a big box of Lego bricks. Mm. If we had just a big bucket of plastic, it'd be very difficult to kind of do anything with it. The fact that we've now kind of broken it all down into little bits, we can now rearrange those bits to create different patterns.
Yeah.
And maybe knowledge is the patterns we make out of those symbolic atoms. Maybe that's how language works.